Today in Studio 360, Lucy Liu has made a name for herself as a kind of action hero. But for the last 20 years, she has also been pursuing a second career under a pseudonym. As a painter.
Much to the dismay of a lot of people, I always show up to work with, you know, 3 or 4, maybe 7 bags of stuff. And I bring it to the trailer because I just never know if inspiration is going to strike.
And later in the hour, we'll go down to New Orleans to hear the album that brought a previously little-known part of Mardi Gras to the world.
The music culture of New Orleans, I mean, it's really a way of life. And if you don't like what my big chief says, you can Giacomo Finale.
All that, plus the strange story behind the strange cult movie that people love to hate, The Room.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
That's all ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Our mission here every week is a show and tell of the finest in art and culture, the new and amazing, the classic and underappreciated. Today, a film that is none of the above.
You don't understand anything, man. Leave your stupid comments in your pocket.
The strange but true story of The Room. If it's not the worst movie of the 21st century, it's definitely a contender.
The Room feels like it was broadcast from another planet. The reason for that is just the weird formal conventions of filmmaking that Tommy recognizes, but he doesn't really understand. And so it just feels so strange and mystifying to watch.
Why, Lisa? Please talk to me, please!
But first, we've probably all done it. You're listening to some pop song and like what you hear, or even just remember a song from your youth, and you Google the lyrics.
I got my eyes on you. You're everything that I see. I won't show high love and emotion endlessly. I can't get
Google gets millions of lyric searches every day. You end up at Rap Genius or Lyrics Freak or one of the other hundreds of sites seeking your clicks and eyeballs. This week, the National Music Publishers Association, the NMPA, took action against those sites, saying they, quote, engage in blatantly illegal behavior which significantly impacts songwriters' ability to make a living. What they mean is the song lyric sites are making money from advertising and the musicians aren't. The NMPA sent cease and desist notices to the 50 most popular sites, a list they got from David Lowry. Lowry is a musician, a founder of the 80s band Camper Van Beethoven and the 90s band Cracker, who has become maybe the foremost advocate for songwriters' rights in the digital age. David Lowry, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
When we talked before some months ago, I totally understand and understood why you're upset about sites like Pandora paying artists pittances for playing their music. I'm not sure I understand what's wrong with fans just finding and reading the lyrics on third-party sites.
Well, the music publishing business, which is the song in abstract, had kind of made an effort to go around and license a bunch of these sites and basically bring them from being gray market sites into being legitimate sites. So a lot of the sites are licensed. And they don't generate a huge amount of revenue for me personally, but I just like to know that somebody went out there and asked permission and that there is some sort of legitimate scheme for monetizing like my work as a songwriter in the digital age when it clearly is valuable.
Right. I'm glad we talked. I had no idea there were legitimate lyric sites and ones that were just hot-dogging and not having any deals. I thought they were all that way. So that's an important point.
Yeah, and this was kind of the quiet little success story of the music business in, you know, sort of post Napster was to get most of the most popular lyric sites into a license system.
Apart from they should all be part of this legitimate system, in your view, it helps music generally and artists generally by encouraging fan interest in, what was that line? I don't quite understand it in the song. Let me look it up. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's many different levels of engagement, you know, and that's one important one, is what exactly is the artist saying, and the fan being able to sort of figure that out and engage on another level with the artist.
And the National Music Publishers Association and you want what?
The license. They just pay, they just get in the system.
Right.
There's at least three agencies that can license them. As a songwriter, that's what I would like to see, is not for these sites to go away, but just for them, if they're generating revenue, if they're getting investments from large venture capital companies,
right,
they should be licensed.
And this is not, I mean, if this comes to pass, it's not going to make anybody not only not rich, the financial impact, it seems, wouldn't be great. It's more the principle of the thing, yeah?
Everything I've done as an artist rights advocate is not just about the principles for songwriters, but for anybody who generates content.
Right.
We're all in the same boat. We all need to be asked permission for the use of our content. Otherwise, we're going to end up in a world that we will not like.
Yep.
And your Instagram photos are the same as my song lyrics, and permission is the basis of civilization, is what I like to say.
David Lowery, thank you very much.
All right.
David Lowery has written songs for the bands Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven, and he also runs The Tricordist, a blog that advocates for musicians' rights in the digital age. So what do you think? Should musicians be making a little money from Google searches for their lyrics? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
Everything is free now. That's what they say. Everything I ever done, gonna give it away.
Coming up, we'll take you inside a movie that's so bad, it's magnificent.
No, I think Tommy tried to make an absolutely volcanically serious American drama.
The stranger-than-fiction story of The Room. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Thank you, Holly. This is a beautiful party. You invited all my friends. Good thinking.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. 20 years ago, a promising young New York artist started showing her paintings and photographs at galleries in Soho. Over the years, Yu Ling built a respectable career with exhibits in Los Angeles, Miami, Munich, and London, as well as New York. Then, a few years ago, the art world learned the truth about Yu Ling. She's Lucy Liu.
You may not be able to fight like a samurai, but you can at least die like a samurai.
Yep. That Lucy Liu, the co-star of Ally McBeal, Charlie's Angels, Kill Bill, and now the CBS series Elementary, about a modern-day Sherlock Holmes and Watson. So, Yu Ling and Lucy Liu, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having us.
Exactly. I had no idea you were a visual artist. Did you have, as a young person, an aha moment where you decided you needed to do this?
I think as a young person, creativity was not something that we were encouraged to sort of think about, work on, just sort of even live in.
Really?
In that space. It was very much about survival, you know, just getting by.
So when did you discover that I want to make art, I want to act, all those things?
I discovered it when I was very young, but it seemed like it was something that was just very trivial in terms of pursuing it as a career. And then once I left NYU, I was there for a year, I transferred to the University of Michigan, I sort of just started taking classes that I wanted to take. And it was my first foray outside of the city, and it was also my first time away from my family, and I just chose all the different classes that I wanted to take. I took art history. I took Chinese. I took ceramics. I took, you know, anything that I thought was interesting. And then I sort of discovered that it was nobody was stopping me or, you know, grabbing me by the shoulder.
Not even your parents?
No, I mean, they weren't really aware of the classes I was taking. They never asked. I was the third born, and my sister had gone to Cornell, my brother Columbia. So I think they were sort of at that point just, I was out loose.
I know how that youngest child thing goes. You get away with murder.
You get away with things, and nobody's checking. I mean, if you're still alive, you know, and you have a heartbeat, then everything's okay.
Exactly. So you get out of college. Do you think, I'm going to be an actor, I'm going to be a painter, I'm going to be both? What was the idea?
When I got out of college, I knew that I was going to be an actor. I had a very pivotal moment at the end of the year where I did a play and I was cast as the lead. And that was the first time I recognized that as somebody who was Asian, I could do something that was not behind the scenes. And I always felt that it was something that I couldn't achieve. You know, there was nobody in entertainment on the forefront of it that had an Asian face.
Well, there barely is now.
They're still working on it.
That's charitable.
Coming together slowly. But that was the first time I recognized there was a possibility, and I just grabbed it.
What made you decide you would do one under this pseudonym and one under your name?
When I came out with a show in, I went to Munich and I did a show there, I decided to use my Chinese name because I did not want people to judge the work or come just because it was me. I wanted it to be more of an open...
It was after you had gotten success as
an
actor.
Yes, exactly. I think that when I decided to put a book together just 2 years ago was when the person said, well, we should probably use your real name. And I thought about it for a while and I realized that, you know what, people are going to criticize whether or not you use your name or not, or they're going to come or they're going to see it or not. I decided to sort of embrace it fully and just go for it.
In 2004, you're a movie star. You've just been in Kill Bill. You move back to New York and enroll at the New York Studio School. What were you thinking? Why did you need to do that?
Yes, and I'll give you the reasoning behind that. As I went to a couple of different galleries, and they said, "Well, what's your background? Where's your degree?" And apparently, it seemed like nobody really wanted to get involved if you didn't have a master's.
Really, you couldn't just say, "Hey, I'm Lucy Liu."
No, that's not going to buy you anything but pain and trouble. So that's when I started thinking that maybe this is something that I need to do in order to, you know, be considered a real artist.
Well, that's wrong, but okay, I get it.
It was wrong because I think in the end, it's not about having a degree; it's about your work and what that presentation is. And while I was in school, I really learned that, you know, I don't really need to pursue a master's. I love being in classes. I love painting. I love doing sculpture. And if people like it or they want to be a part of it, then great.
So this new project, 72, which are 72 paintings, and there's a limited edition of prints, and this is what you've done recently. Tell me about that. How did this come to be?
I saw this chart that had all of these different descriptions of things like energy and success and fertility and health. And I thought it was very interesting because it was sort of broken down like how Chinese is written, you know, in blocks and in a very organized manner, which is a lot of times how I like to work. And I was inspired by that. And I thought it would be really amazing to sort of do a painting per one of those characters. And so I put a book together of that and then included the meditations of that in the back of the book, which I wrote.
The pictures in the 72, more than earlier work of yours I've seen, seem to be referring explicitly to traditional Chinese forms. They are black and white. They're abstract. Where did that come from? Where did that decision come from?
You know, it's an interesting question. It just seemed very natural for me to go in that direction. I had been using a lot of color, a lot of thick paint.
Doing figurative things?
Yeah, something more figurative. It was something that was much simpler for me. You know, simpler in terms of what I wanted to do. I wanted to sort of just take everything out and condense it into one object, one thought. And I wanted it to be a fast movement. I wanted to have an expression without too much time, you know, not allowing myself that much time. Because I think sometimes you can overwork something. And that was an experiment for me to try. And I think it was probably my most successful. Because I didn't think about it so much.
And do you paint while you're working? I mean, doing a show, 22 episodes a year, that's a lot of work. Do you do between that? I mean, how do those two parts of your life fit in together?
It's basically a flow. If I have smaller works, I'll bring them with me. If I have larger pieces, I'll just go back to the studio and work on it. But I always have something on hand, generally. I never am empty-handed. And, you know, much to the dismay of a lot of people, I always show up to work with, you know, three or four, maybe seven bags of stuff. And I bring it to the trailer and, you know, because I just never know if I'm going to have time or if inspiration is going to strike.
So in this show, Elementary, you're starring as Watson, Joan Watson, opposite Johnny Lee Miller as Sherlock Holmes. I read that you turned down this role again and again when it was offered at first.
I turned it down the first time because I was concerned about the fact that it was another incarnation of Holmes and Watson. And I felt that it would be, again, something that would be under the microscope of the critics and other people that were huge fans. And I also thought that it could work without the names. You could just substitute anybody's name. It could be Johnson and Smith, you know, why not? But Rob Doherty, who I work with, and I just think he's wonderful.
Who created the show.
Yeah, he's the creator of the show, was very firm and very clear and very confident about the use of that and the history of that and the literature that, you know, he wanted to sort of embed in there, but at the same time modernize it.
Holmes in the show is a recovering heroin addict, and it's set in present-day New York. You start out as his sort of recovery buddy, coach, and then become his detective partner. I want to play a clip. This is a scene where the two of you are sitting at a cafe on a stakeout.
Do you think we're cut off from the world? You know, neither of us dates, neither of us really goes out much. At all, actually.
We're not cut off from the world. We're engaged in creating one that's actually worth living in.
Well, my friend signed me up for this dating website, and I think I'm going to put my profile up. You know, so be nice if I bring anyone around, okay?
Won't be an issue.
Why won't it be an issue?
Because you won't actually bring anyone around. I've lived most of my life with the firm conviction that romantic love is a delusion. It's a futile hedge against the existential terror that is our own singularity. Then I met someone who calls herself Irene Adler, and that forced me to re-examine those convictions. She, of course, turned out to be a criminal.
Never really discussed how that made you feel.
I feel liberated.
That was Lucy Liu and Johnny Lee Miller in Elementary. It's interesting that you are very much playing the Watson role, even in character moments like that. Did you... once you decided to do it, did you go back and read Arthur Conan Doyle?
Absolutely. Actually, it was the first time I had read any of the literature at all. It was not something that we grew up reading,
right,
or having been, you know, none of – I didn't even – we didn't even have bedtime stories. So when people bring up stories now,
jeez,
I'm sort of shocked. I mean, it wasn't that kind of a life. It was, you know, I mean, my sister – we spoke Chinese at home, so it would be very unlikely for us to learn English
right,
until she went to kindergarten,
yeah,
essentially.
Is there some kind of role – I mean, you've done a range of roles – played bad people, good people, in between people. Is there something you've always wanted to do that would be against type? That why can't I get cast as that?
For a while, I was really getting a lot of offers and cast as sort of the baddie, you know.
Off of the Ally McBeal character.
It was sort of the stunts and the action and that kind of.
Oh, and the Kill Bill,
yeah,
I suppose, helped
cutting
as well.
The heads and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
You know, those small things.
Yeah.
And people really wanted that. It sort of got their blood going.
The price you pay for bringing up either my Chinese or American heritage as a negative is, I collect your f***ing head.
And it's funny because I didn't really enlist myself in that field when I started. And I had to learn those things and really engage myself in a physical manner that I did not know that I was going to have to do.
Yeah.
And so the one thing that I can say that is a bit of a struggle is not being able to portray characters that were in history already, you know, because there's a lot of emphasis.
Because history has left out Asian people?
They say that the Asian generation is the invisible generation, basically, that, you know, because you're not black and because you're not white, then people don't think that you have prejudice. And I don't completely agree with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't find that it's always the case that people of Asian descent are going to, you know, protest and make a big stink out of something. You know,
right,
in our culture, there is something that's about acceptance and about, you know, saving face. And so it's a very different dynamic that we have in terms of the struggle that
well,
we try to express ourselves.
And there is also as long as we're trucking in stereotypes here, something about, no, don't go into acting, become a doctor, become an engineer. I mean, is that part of it as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I had that for sure. And it's not even about don't go into acting. It was sort of like, what is that? There's not even a category for art, you know.
But you're growing up in New York, but that had no impact on how your parents thought of what that might mean.
Absolutely not. Because we grew up in Queens, in Jackson Heights. We went to school. We came back from school. We were latchkey kids. We let ourselves in. We did our homework. We watched TV. They came home. You know, it's just we ate a TV dinner. We went to bed. And TV dinner was not like a bad thing. It was like a luxury.
I love TV dinner.
It was a luxury to have a TV dinner.
And once it all worked out, this career that they had no basis for imagining or understanding, were your parents thrilled, as parents should be?
I'm not sure thrilled is in the category.
Really?
I think it was just about, she's not going to starve on the street. She's not going to jump from from the Hollywood sign. My father was very upset when I left New York to come to Los Angeles, and I hadn't heard from him for a very long time. And then one day I got a check for $100. And I just was out of nowhere, not really any note attached or anything like that. And then I found out later that he had read in a paper that an actress who wasn't doing well had jumped from the sign. And he was afraid that I was going to be, in that position. But it's a different form of expression of showing concern.
So they're more relieved than ecstatic.
Exactly. Relief is a really – are they relieved? Yes. Absolutely. Well, exclamation
point. Congratulations. Lucy Liu, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
You can see Lucy Liu in Elementary on Thursday nights, and you can see some of her paintings at studio360.org.
Now, if any of you sons of got anything else to say, now's the time!
I didn't think so.
It is safe to state that the grandchildren of some of the people in this theater will not be born on Earth.
Seems like every generation finds a bad movie to love, where the title becomes a punchline, like Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Zombies guided by a master plan for complete domination of the Earth.
Bad movies that think they're good, like Showgirls.
I used to love Doggy Chow.
I used to love Doggy Chow, too.
And younger people today, their bad movie, possibly the Citizen Kane of bad movies, is called The Room. Krista Ripple takes us inside.
At midnight on a recent Friday, I stood in line to see a movie I've already seen four times, a movie called The Room. Most people online with me had already seen it, too.
It is like watching mental mayhem being manifested on the big screen. It is a movie that was never fully formed and was birthed very premature by somebody who should have never been a mother.
The basic plot of The Room is there's a love triangle between a guy, Johnny, his fiancée, Lisa, and Johnny's best friend, Mark. Lisa is sick of Johnny.
I don't love him anymore.
And now she's set her eyes on Mark.
What's the matter? Don't you like me? I'm your girl.
Johnny's my best friend. All right, you're going to be married next month. Come on.
They have an affair, full of melodrama and dialogue that I can't even really explain it.
I'm going to do what I want to do, and that's it. What do you think I should do?
One of my favorite zingers is from Mark in a moment of anguish.
You don't understand anything, man. Leave your stupid comments in your pocket.
It's not just the dialogue. The Room is full of characters who disappear halfway through the movie in gaping plot holes that are never resolved. One character tells her daughter she has cancer, and that's the last we hear of it. And then there are bits like the infamous flower shop scene.
Hi.
Can I help you?
Yeah, can I have a dozen red roses, please?
Oh, hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go.
That's me. How much is it?
It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Since it came out in 2003, The Room has developed a fan base around the globe. It shows in big cities, in college towns, even Paris and London. Hollywood stars like David Cross and Kristen Bell are fans. Going to a screening is a very Rocky Horror experience. You get to shout things at the screen and throw plastic spoons. The spoons thing is because there are framed pictures of plastic spoons decorating Johnny and Lisa's apartment. Why are they there? I've seen The Room 4 times and I have no idea. So I asked Tommy Wiseau, the movie's writer, director, producer, and star.
Oh, that's good. That's a good question. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the expression, plastic is cheaper than wood.
I'm not, no.
Well, this means that, long time ago, wood was inexpensive and vice versa. Now the plastic is less cheaper than wood. So we produce a lot of stuff with plastic we cannot live without.
Okay, but why are there pictures of spoons?
So to respond to your question, that was on purpose to just provoke the audience, but I didn't, to be honest with you, very honestly, that I did not realize that people would actually, you know, throw a spoon, you know, to the screen, whatever.
Wiseau is cryptic about a lot of things. He cultivates it. He has the black hair and pallid skin of a vampire. He won't say where he's from. And he's cagey about how he financed The Room. Wiseau claims that all along he was trying to create a black comedy.
No. I think Tommy tried to make a absolutely volcanically serious American drama. I think in his mind it probably is a serious American drama. And I think he's made a dollar out of 25 cents with the cultural status of The Room.
That's Tom Bissell. He's a journalist and a big fan of The Room.
The Room feels like it was broadcast from another planet. And the reason for that is just the weird formal conventions of filmmaking that Tommy recognizes, but he doesn't really understand. And so that is why The Room is never boring. That's why people can watch it over and over again, because it just feels so strange and mystifying to watch.
How many times have you seen it?
Over 50 and less than 100, I would say, probably.
Bissell wrote a book about The Room. His co-author is the only person who might be able to explain Tommy Wiseau.
My name is Greg Sestero. I co-starred in the movie The Room.
Greg plays Mark, the cheating best friend.
Why did you do this to me? Johnny's my best friend.
Greg and Tommy met years earlier in an acting class, trying to make it as professionals.
He was really the life raft that I had if I wanted to go out and pursue this. When you do things like this, your family's like, you're crazy, you're going to end up homeless. And it was refreshing to have somebody say, listen to the right voices in your head.
Tommy offered Greg his apartment in L.A. so he could be close to Hollywood. Then it got weird. Greg says Tommy was possessive. He'd call at all hours, leaving message after message. Tommy would copy things Greg did. They fought. Greg says it came to a boiling point when they went to see The Talented Mr. Ripley, the 1999 movie. It's about the relationship between two young men. A loser who attaches himself obsessively to his popular friend.
To be honest, I'm a little relieved you're going. I think we've seen enough of each other for a while.
What?
You can be a leech. You know that. And it's boring. You can be quite boring.
In the book, Greg writes about watching Ripley with Tommy.
I'd seen several movies with Tommy. He'd always get bored and restless before it was over. Or he'd shout, boring, in the middle of the film. There's better acting in the Gene Shelton class. When Ripley started, though, Tommy didn't talk. He didn't stir. He was wide-eyed and riveted from the very first scene.
Oh, we have to get you. Okay. Ah!
When the scene of Tom beating Dickie to death came to pass, Tommy actually leaned back and clamped his hand over his mouth. Even though if he didn't realize that he was seeing a part of himself, I think there's always a point when you're scared of not fitting in that you cut off before someone else can cut you off. And I think it sent a message to Tommy to explore that part of himself, even though maybe he didn't really realize exactly what the film was telling him.
That's Greg's interpretation. There are certainly similar themes in both movies. Friendship, betrayal, a homoerotic undercurrent. I asked Tommy if Ripley was an inspiration for The Room.
The answer is no. You see, I'm speaking for myself, not what Greg's applied, you see. his opinion could be different, so I have my own opinion. Okay.
Here's Tom Bissell again.
Greg illuminated for me something that I had sensed but didn't know, which was that lying behind this movie was this immense well of real human emotion and, you know, basic human torment. I mean, the guy who made this movie is a complicated man, and he tried to communicate something deep and profound to him. The well of emotion behind the movie, I think you can just see it. And that's what makes it so hard, for me at least, to like look down my nose at it, because there's something about it that's just so sincere that kind of breaks your heart.
It's hard not to laugh at The Room. And in his public appearances, Tommy just acts crazy. I once saw him stagger around the stage like a zombie fighting off an Ambien. He pretends he's in on the joke. But if you watch this movie at home by yourself, it's easy to recognize how earnest it is.
I think it's creative people really respond to this movie the most. And I think that's because the average creative person lives in a state of constant doubt about their own artistic potency. And then you see this mysterious man just waltz onto the screen with as much confidence as like the Sultan of Brunei and just lording around the screen like he owns it. And yet his performance would be no one's estimation of competent acting.
You can love someone deep inside your heart, and there is nothing wrong with it. If a lot of people love each other, the world would be a better place to live.
It's that brave, reckless earnestness that keeps people lining up to see The Room.
He's funny in an odd sort of way, in a sad sort of... He's like the born loser or something. But in any event, he's sort of inspiring through failure. In some way, he provides inspiration to sorts like me, you know?
And if that's hard for you to imagine, you should really just go see The Room and bring spoons. For Studio 360, I'm Krista Ripple.
If you're still having trouble getting your head around The Room, we've posted a clip at studio360.org. Greg Sestero and Tom Bissell's book, The Disaster Artist, is out now. Coming up, one of the funkiest records ever to come out of New Orleans. And that's saying something. The Wild Chapatulas, coming up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Free up your mind. Use your imagination.
We are the music makers. And we are the dreamers of dreams.
Come along.
The writer Daniel Alarcon's star is high and steadily rising. He got his MFA from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, published his debut short story in The New Yorker, and then got named to that magazine's pantheon of 20 under 40. And critics adore him. In his first book, a collection of short stories called War by Candlelight, and his first novel, Lost City Radio, Alarcon wrote about the fault lines of war and politics and culture in an unnamed South American country, which closely resembles Peru, where he was born and lived until he was 3 years old. His new novel is called At Night We Walk in Circles. Daniel Alarcon, welcome to Studio 360.
It's good to be here, Kurt.
So, like in a lot of short stories you've written, and in your previous novel, Lost City Radio, you've set At Night We Walk in Circles in this unnamed Latin American country after a guerrilla civil war. Before we talk about the book, do you feel as though, okay, I'm done with this subject now?
Maybe. I do feel like I spent a lot of my imaginative life in this unnamed city, in this unnamed country.
Which isn't Lima or Peru.
it's not not Peru.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, yeah. and I think that's something that I think is important to clarify, because it's not me being coy so much as it's me giving myself a certain amount of free rein.
Your biography is interesting, and I know that there are parts of it they are brought up in ways that bug you. But your Peruvian doctor parents moved to the United States in 1980. You were very little. Your childhood in Alabama coincided almost exactly with the Peruvian insurgencies. Growing up, did you hear about them, know about them? Were your parents talking about what was going on in Peru?
Yeah, for sure. We were not political refugees. We left because my parents found work at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. We were very fortunate to leave when we left and miss out on this pretty terrible decade. But it was certainly something we discussed, and it was something we you could see the worry in my parents' faces when they talked about it. You could see how they devoured news from Peru whenever it came. The connection was cultural and spiritual and deep. And then when the war touched us pretty directly, touched my family pretty directly with the loss of certain family members, of course, at that point, you know, there was no way of ignoring it.
The main character in this novel, Nelson, is this young actor, an aspiring playwright, and a bit of a sort of kind of callow and a bit of a snob and a poser.
Mm-hmm.
Were you installing your own unflattering version of yourself in Nelson, or is he an entirely different person than you?
Well, I would venture to say that most 22, 23-year-old
are jerks.
are callow, are snobs. I mean, especially the ones with ambitions to be artists. You know, posing is all in the eye of the beholder. I mean,
and how we figure out who we are.
You pose until it becomes authentic, really.
Yeah.
I'm not a big believer in authenticity as it is. You know, I think that most people are acting all the time, and I feel that's just the way of the world.
And so you feel – you share some DNA with a guy, or you did when you were his age.
Yeah, I'm totally real now.
Good. And you're inherently inauthentic. What?
Great. You know, I share DNA with all my characters.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty obvious.
Your narrator of this novel is also a writer who pieces together Nelson's story through research and interviews, fictional research and interviews, in a way that sometimes reads like journalism. Why did you decide to tell the story that way, in this with this kind of detached narrator, but not an omniscient third person?
Yeah, I didn't. It wasn't a decision. I wrote a first draft of this book, finished in 2010, threw it all out, started over. I kept 8 or 9 pages from that book, and as I was building on those 8 or 9 pages, this I voice just slipped in. And at first, I didn't really know who this voice was, why he was there, what his relationship to the story was. And then I realized that if I didn't answer that question soon, the question was going to become very important and I better have a really good answer.
Yeah.
And I just kept postponing it. And by postponing answering the question, you're just raising the stakes.
Yes, yes.
I would wake up in the middle of the night wondering who the hell was telling my story until I figured it out about 14, 16 months later.
So you have this writer character writing about a writer character who's investigating a writer
You're
character.
Making it sound boring.
No, I know, but it's not. I want to make clear that it's not boring at all. But did that kind of meta world within world thing, was that a thing at the beginning, or did that just come about accidentally?
That just
as well?
Comes about accidentally. I think you just start playing with the characters and putting them in motion. And I think of it almost like billiards, you know, you just break up the balls and see where they start hitting.
That's a good metaphor for the nature of writing a big thing.
I still got it, man.
You grow up this American kid in the American heartland. I mean, I can see being interested in where I came from, but you really committed to it.
I mean, I think of myself as 100% American and 100% Peruvian, and I don't think that there's any contradiction there. I guess what you're asking is, why would I decide to be Peruvian as well?
Well, why were you not even decide? I expect it wasn't a decision so much as I am really deeply fascinated with, engaged with this country that I barely remember if I remember, and I'm going to write stories and books and make half of my career about it.
Yeah. That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I tend to be interested in things that are dangerous or sordid.
Yeah.
As opposed to like writing about like, you know, the local YMCA or like, you know, membership at the pool in Hoover, Alabama or...
And there's so many beautiful pieces of great epic novels written about those things.
I'm just going to leave that with no comment.
Did you speak Spanish at home growing up?
Of course.
Yeah. So it was a totally bilingual household?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the thing is you develop a kind of domestic Spanish. I'm hungry for dinner, mom, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was a great frustration to me at a certain age to just, you know, go as an adult to Peru and be unable to have sophisticated conversations about politics or literature or music or film in Spanish. And so I spent many years just listening. And I think that ended up being very useful for me.
And what do your parents think of their American son being so deeply connected to, fascinated by this country and culture they left 30 years ago?
Well, they didn't leave it. I mean, they left the country, but they didn't leave the culture. You don't leave your culture. You know, you take your culture with you wherever you go. So for them, I don't think it's that strange.
Really? They're not surprised?
No. I mean, why would they be? Our house was Peru.
Right. But the classic, you know, American immigrant story is, oh, my children don't care about the old country kind of thing.
Yes, that is the classic story. I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, you're not raised in terms of classic stories. You're raised in terms of, you know,
the life and your relationship with your kid.
Yeah, and the family we had, you know, and it wasn't like jammed down our throats. It just was who we were,
right?
You know?
In your first novel, Lost City Radio, you wrote about a Latin American radio show that tried to reunite families of the disappeared. And now you're actually producing this radio program called Radio Ambulante. What is it with you and radio?
I have a radio family. You know, my father was a radio guy in Arequipa, Peru in the 1950s.
That was him?
That was him. Yeah. And also we grew up making little homemade radio programs for my cousins back in Lima.
That you would do here and send back?
Yeah, on cassette tape. Basically like, you know, the Alarcón Variety Hour where we'd gather in my parents' bedroom on Sundays. My dad would break out the tape recorder. He would interview us for the family back home.
That's about the cutest thing I've ever heard.
There you go. And then we'd get tapes like that back from Lima.
Huh. So tell me about this program of yours, this actual grown-up program. Radio Ambulante means, what is the best colloquial translation of that?
I guess you could call it radio on the move. You know, an ambulante is a street vendor. Our logo kind of says it all. It's a guy pushing a radio speaker. And to us, the ambulante is a symbol of the go-getter, symbol of Latin American cities, and all U.S. cities that have a large Latin American population have the ambulante, the person who goes out and knows what's happening in the neighborhood, knows where they're coming from, knows where they're going, and is not waiting around for someone to create work for them, but is just a go-getter.
I've thought for a while since I've been in public radio with 35 or 40 million Spanish-speaking Americans.
55.
That seems just, you know, get 1% of that or 5% of that. That's enough for more than your show. That's enough for a bunch of shows, it seems like.
You know, it seems to me that cultural borders are extraordinarily fluid and that if you have 55 million Spanish speakers, then you can honestly say the United States is a Latin American country. It's not to say that
There are certain people who don't want to hear that.
I just said it and I'll say it again. The United States is a Latin American country. I mean, it's not that it isn't an Anglo-American country, but just as it's an African country, just as it's a, you know, a European country, an Asian country.
Yep.
This is not – I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm just stating a fact.
Right.
You know, there's more Spanish speakers here than in Peru where I was born.
And more English speakers in China than here. So it's a crazy world.
Yeah, it is a crazy world. It's a beautiful crazy world in that respect.
It has been great talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk again one of these days. Daniel Alarcón, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Daniel Alarcón's new novel, At Night We Walk in Circles, is available now. I don't need to walk around in circles, walk around in circles, walk around in circles, walk around. If you've spent time in New Orleans, or if you watch the TV show Tremé, you may know about one of the most idiosyncratic customs of that highly idiosyncratic town. The Mardi Gras Indians are social clubs, African-American social clubs that take on the names of fictitious Indian tribes with costumes and rituals and their own special expressions. It's a tradition that goes back to the 19th century. In 1976, a record came out that brought this music of the Mardi Gras Indians to a wider audience for the first time. It featured all four Neville brothers and an all-star New Orleans backing band. The record was called The Wild Chapatulas, and this year it was entered into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. We've got three experts to tell its story.
And if you don't like what the big chief said, you just shock move me now here.
My name is Jan Ramsey, and I'm the founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of Offbeat Magazine in New Orleans.
My name is Big Queen Rita, Loretta Dallas. I'm the queen of the Wild Magnolias.
My name is Cyril Neville, and if you don't like what my big chief says, you can jock a move me now.
And my brother,
when I was growing up, all I wanted to see was the Indians.
The Mardi Gras Indians are African Americans who are dressed in exaggerated Native American style. And I mean lots of brightly colored feathers and sequins and beaded suits. And it's really an amazing phenomenon.
A lot of the things that happens in New Orleans is you are born into it. You don't just choose it. That's a tradition that's passed down from one generation to the next.
The Neville brothers had an uncle whose name was George Landry.
His nickname was Jolly because you never saw him with a frown on his face. He was, as far as I'm concerned, a giant. And one of the people who put New Orleans culture on the map.
When I met Big Chief Jolly, was at his Indian practice for the Wild Chapatulas, which was on Chapatula Street.
The album that they put together was a tribute to Chief Jolly and the Wild Chapatulas. It took some of the music and the chants of the Mardi Gras Indians to a much more of a general audience.
What makes that record really a true classic is that's the Meters, the Neville brothers, and the Wild Chapatulas on that record. You know, it's like the whole thing about the Indian thing on that day is that you coming out to meet other Indians. And it's like meeting another nation. So every dignitary in that nation has to meet his counterpart.
We have Spy Boy, Flag Boy.
The Spy Boy would meet the Spy Boy. The Flag Boy would meet the Flag Boy.
I'm a big queen, I'll meet the big queen.
And it was all about nobody could get past these guys to get to the chief.
Indians coming from all over town. Big chief singing, gonna take 'em down.
By the time it got to the chief's meeting, it was this frenzy that was going on that you knew things could go either way.
And what it really is when you meet that particular person is like you showing off your costume, okay? You're talking to them, letting them know what gang you are. And then you dance a little bit. They got tambourines, they got the bass drum, and then they'll shake hands, and then that tribe go one way, the other tribe go the other way.
Yeah.
Our uncle, you know, like I said, he was an icon. He wasn't just Big Chief Jolly to us. He was Big Chief Jolly to everybody in the 12th Ward, the 13th Ward, all the way up to the 16th Ward. And everything from the way he talked, the way he walked, the clothes he wore, and everything was, you know, something that you wanted to pattern yourself by. I've heard my brother Aaron even say that was the same thing with him. He wanted to You know, like at one time I wanted to be Aaron. He at one time wanted to be Jolly.
When the Mardi Gras music come on in Mardi Gras season, that helps you at night while you're sewing on your Indian suit. And it motivates you. It keeps you pumped up.
I mean, it's really a way of life. And the music culture of New Orleans came together on that Wild Chapatulas record.
That was Cyril Neville of the Neville Brothers. We also heard from Big Queen Rita and Jan Ramsey. The 1976 album Wild Chapatulas was entered into the National Recording Registry this year. Our Peabody Award-winning series on the registry is produced by Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich from BMP Audio. And you can hear lots more of those stories of American musical icons at studio360.org. I'm afraid that's it for this week's Studio 360 Parade. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, but until then, you can visit us anytime on Facebook and Twitter. Let us know what you think. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Posey Gruner,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. And a final note this week, we're saying goodbye and good luck to one of our old guard,
Michelle Siegel.
Michelle has been a producer on Studio 360 since we first went on the air, and if you're a regular listener, you've heard her work again and again and again over the years, in hundreds of segments. Thanks for everything, Michelle.
Yay!
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
Yeah, that's it. bye, take care. Thanks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, before there was Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, there was this guy, Will Rogers.
We'll hold the distinction of being the only nation in the history of the world that ever went to the poorhouse in an automobile.
The great granddaddy of American political comedy, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.